Hello again and welcome to another episode of Quick Question with Soren and Daniel, an advice podcast where two friends vow to answer all of life's questions each week until one of them loses steam. I am, speaking of, Daniel O'Brien, writer for Last Week Tonight and author of the book How to Fight Presidents, joined as always by Soren Bowie. Soren, what's up?
Hey, what's going on? I really like that you said that one of us might just give up on this at some point, as opposed to something catastrophic might happen.
No, and I don't even mean like one of us will give up on the podcast. I mean the podcast generally ends where, like, I don't know if eagle-eared listeners can tell when I start texting towards the end of an episode or like get distracted by a puzzle or something, but it happens. It happens right around the time that Soren reminds us that it's time to leave.
There was a time I can remember back when we would have meetings together when we worked at the same job, and you always had your laptop in front of you. It always looked like you were doing a lot of work until you would go, fuck shit. And it meant that whatever Jumpman game you were playing, you fell into a pit somewhere.
I was either playing City Jumper or a version of Tetris called Tetralapse.
Oh, yeah. You got us all hooked on Tetralapse.
Tetralapse fucking rules. And I've, you know, obviously had some time to myself recently, as we all have. And I've beaten Tetralapse a few times over now.
Okay.
And I can't decide if it's going to be important to me what my score is. Or because Tetralapse, right, the way that it works is it's up to 20 levels and then you stop. You can get a better score. And in the past, I've just been just trying to finish it. And now it's like you run a marathon and it's like, do I want to be a person who has completed a marathon or do I want to like beat my time now? Do I want to
do I want to be a guy with a PR?
Yeah. And on the subject of marathons, I don't. But this Tetris thing, I might go for a PR in Tetris.
Okay. I completed the game Red Dead Redemption 2, which is, as the Soricide Squad who listens to the show will know. Mm-hmm. And I still go back to it occasionally to play it. I don't know why. There's nothing new for me to find there. It's just I enjoy the feeling of it.
Oh, I thought that was one of those like big world games where you could just sort of, if you don't follow the mission, you could just do whatever you want. Is it not that?
It is a lot of that, but there's like little side missions. I've done all of those too. I mean, my first playthrough, when I play a video game, I do a broad sweep the entire way through, so I make sure I don't miss anything. Now there are little things I could do that are just for me, like carry the night folk who are these like zombie type people to a KKK meeting and just see what happens. But like I don't have anything new that the game isn't providing any new storylines for me.
You know what I think? I'm Googling now to see, because I don't know. You have PS4, right? Is that your only thing?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if Firewatch is available on PS. Oh, it is. You should try Firewatch.
Okay.
It's a mystery. It's kind of like Myst, but a little bit more accessible, I think. You're in Wyoming in like your job is to be like stationed out there to look for fires, I guess. It's 1989 and you have one person that you're talking to on the end of like a walkie-talkie, and just this big strange mystery unfolds while Ooh. You're just out by yourself, and it's like a beautiful game to look at too.
Oh yeah, that's what I live for.
Yeah. Do you want to say hi to our listeners?
Oh yeah, sure. That's my job now. I got to be better at this. What I need is just like, I want to be like Ed McMahon and you just like throw to me.
Yeah.
And I can just come up with it. Do you want to try that?
Right.
Okay, let's do it again.
Hey, Soren, do you want to say hi to our listeners?
Yeah, our listeners who prefer to be called the query eye for the straight reply.
Oh, I think I like that one.
Do you?
No.
Okay. Maybe one of those ones that just hits you later. They're like you warm to it.
Straight reply. Do you want to unpack
because
that at all?
There's no quick in there by any means. It's just the query eye.
That's fine.
And then straight reply. Like I was also going for the answer. Like you'd had a gold nugget when you did questicular answer.
Yeah.
So I was just like hunting in that same vein and... It's just
No. That does work better than I thought it did. Just based on, because I live on the internet as much as I do, when I hear straight reply, I know it's a play on straight guy, but my brain has already connected straight reply and guy at that time. And reply guy has such a very specific connotation in my head that I didn't know if you were calling us, you and I, reply guys.
No, I see what you're saying. And this, I wouldn't say that our show is necessarily for reply guys.
Right.
So that's, I see why that's confusing. And those are the, they wouldn't call themselves reply guys.
No.
This one's muddy. This one's muddy. I'm going to do a better one next time.
Okay. Well,
do you want to try it again? Just like right now?
No.
Okay.
Do you want to, I've been trying to find like the best way to articulate what a reply guy is. These are two very different things, but in a test version of this episode of this podcast, rather, you had me explain to you what a fuckboy was and why it was a bad thing. That episode has never been released, nor will it, but I liked the spirit of that because terms are constantly emerging on the internet and people with varying levels of familiarity are trying to get up to speed on what they mean. And reply guy is one of those things that, like, intellectually I know what it means as soon as I hear it, but I don't know. I want to master the art of, like, how do I explain to my parents what a reply guy is? How do I explain to a stranger what a reply guy is in a succinct, clear way? And you're
people
aren't
in the same scientific field as we are.
Yeah, right.
How do you make the layman's understand?
Right.
I feel like a reply guy is somebody who jumps into the replies of anything on Twitter to explain what already has been explained in the original post. I don't know if it's always contentious. I think that it's just somebody who either doesn't get the joke or jumps in to re-explain what has clearly already been said.
Would you see, here's the most interesting thing about this to me is that you are not linking this specifically to responses to women.
No.
Is that, I am, okay, that's by design?
Yes. I think that the reply guy should always be gendered. Like that, it's a very specifically a guy who does this, but I don't think it's always, he doesn't always do it to women. It's particularly annoying when he does it to women because I think women have dealt with a lot more of that in just their everyday life that when they see that man online too, it's like, here we fucking go again. But you see it in your own mentions. You've got reply guys, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I think when it... the reason that it in my head has special distinction for women, maybe this will say more about me, is like when someone is in my mentions either misunderstanding a joke or explaining a joke that they didn't need to explain, or just doing something broadly unhelpful, I think, oh, you're a fucking idiot. And it stops there. Like, I don't need a new word for that for me personally. I thought reply guy was a specific Twitter-born evolution of guys who like to correct or undermine women on the internet. But dictionary.com,
that's where it's born from. Yeah.
Dictionary.com, the slang section of internet dictionary.com. Jesus. A reply guy is a term for a man who frequently comments on tweets or other social media posts in an annoying, condescending, forward, or otherwise unsolicited manner, especially posts by women. It can also refer to a person who frequently and zealously responds to posts from famous people on Twitter.
Oh, that's a different definition than I know.
Yeah. All right. Well, we did that. Is that the show? Are we done?
I think, let's see, 12 minutes. That feels good to me.
Okay, yeah. Now let's get into the show. Actually, oh, again, Bacon is again not with us. Our CFO, Bacon, is still out celebrating his recent engagement. We're all very happy for him. We miss him, and one day he will be back to this podcast, we presume. But certainly, like, give him kudos and congrats on Twitter. You can find him at Make Me Bacon, please, please, spelled PLS. Well, let's get into the show where we ask each other questions and try to get answers. Soren, quick question.
Shoot.
Can you think of what is in your mind the biggest missed opportunity in a television show? Mine is a reality show, but yours doesn't have to be. It could be any show that's ever happened where, whether it's you think like you thought a plot was going one way and it swerved and went into this other place, or you thought man, this cast is so great. They've assembled such an amazing team. Why has everyone been squandered, or any other reason in the world for a TV show that really blew an opportunity?
Yeah. Well, it seems like Baltimore should have had more lines in The Wire.
Jesus.
It is the main character after all. Oh, no, I have one. I have one that's recent. Okay. It's just like the one that's top of mind for me. Did you watch the show The Witcher?
Mm-mm.
Oh, okay, great.
I watched one. There's an amazing video that Bacon will put in the footnotes of our website from The Witcher, where Henry Cavill, where he breaks down this incredible fight scene from one of the episodes where he just like mows down a bunch of people and then fights this woman. I don't know any of the characters or their names, but I've never seen a better advertisement for a show than this behind the scenes breakdown of a fight scene. Just Henry Cavill, just wrecking, very articulately talking about the work that went into the fight choreography, and then also seeing the fight choreography and just like not knowing a single other thing. I want to watch this show just based on this behind the scenes thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you know the scene I'm talking about at least?
I do. Yeah. It's a scene where it's what basically sends him on his journey. It's a woman that he kind of falls in love with a little bit, and then she betrays him and gives him no choice but to kill her. I'm not spoiling much because that's very early on in it.
No, yeah. And like she dies in the clip. I see it, so it's fine.
Yeah. Oh, okay, good. Yeah. So she holds a little girl hostage, and he ends up killing he can't stand that, so he kills her. He's one of those characters who is morally righteous. He's very grumpy. He doesn't like people, but he serves this very specific purpose in that world of, he's a hero. He runs around killing monsters so they stop destroying cities and hovels and things.
Okay.
So the premise is, Dan, that the worlds of like elves and dwarves and magic have collided with the worlds of humans, and the humans quickly overpowered all of these wizards and dwarves and elves and the kind of the magic world, but they still have this terrible contention with monsters in that world, and like they don't know how to beat something that's stronger than them. And so what they've done is they've created a witcher, which is somebody that they raise from birth to use the most of their brain, the most of their muscles, and then they've also got the equivalent of sorcery steroids. They've been genetically modified, basically. They call them mutants in it, but it's all through spells and things like that. Mm-hmm. And he's one of these witchers who's cursed to walk the land, freeing everybody else of monsters, but he's going to be alone his whole life.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Is he not allowed to fall in love?
It's not clear. I think he probably is. It's not good. His big motto is don't get attached. So if that is a rule of his, it's by his own design.
Okay.
So it's a pretty cool show. It has a feel very much like a WB show from the early 90s, like Beauty and the Beast or something, where
WB. So for most of our listeners, there used to be these two networks called WB, which was Warner Brothers, Channel 11 in New Jersey, and UPN, which was Channel 9 in New Jersey. And then at some point they merged and became the CW.
That's right. Yeah. So
and also
early,
when that
happened, CW.
Yes. But just to tug on the WB thread a little bit longer, Michigan J. Frog was the spokes frog for the WB until WB famously killed him. They didn't just stop using him as their spokes frog. You can read the Wikipedia on this. They killed Michigan J. Frog. That's why he was no longer their mascot. He was like, he died. I'm sorry, everyone. RIP Michigan J. Frog, 1930, whatever to 1990, whatever. He's dead now. The frog is dead.
Well,
just a little fun fact for everybody.
Did they say how they killed him?
I don't think they listed his cause of death, which usually means drug overdose. But they did make it clear he's dead and not coming back.
That's interesting, because the birth of Michigan J. Frog was a dead frog.
Speak on that.
Okay, so in the old Looney Tunes cartoons, I can't remember who it was, maybe Porky Pig, maybe I think it was some more human character, finds a dead frog, and the frog only gets up and dances and sings for him. And he's thinks he's going to be a millionaire because he's got this frog that can dance and sing. And every
time it's not dead. It's just a normal frog.
No, it's dead.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I don't. I'm not.
We'll hear from the reply guys. Right.
But like, I can remember the frog being in a box and like being limp and him like trying to like dance this dead frog around, and everyone thinks he's a lunatic.
No, I know those cartoons. I just don't remember him being dead.
No, but well, maybe he wasn't dead in all of them.
I have pulled up the Wikipedia page for Michigan J. Frog. When the WB ceased broadcasting and signed off the air for the final time on September 17th, 2006, a white silhouette of Michigan appeared at the end of the montage of stars that appeared on the network during its 11-year history. When the montage ended with "Thank you," Michigan's silhouette is shown removing his top hat and bowing to thank the audience for 11 years, bringing the WB to a close, and later bringing the CW network for the following day, September 18th, 2006.
Okay. Let's see here. I'm going to go look at these old episodes of... my internet in my garage apparently isn't very good.
Oh, actually, on July 22nd, 2005, Michigan's death was announced by WB chairman. So this is before the network closed its doors. The frog is dead and buried, the WB chairman said.
What a power move. For no reason. You just didn't like the frog?
Yeah. The head of programming for the WB, David Genolieri, said that Michigan was a symbol that perpetuated the young teen feel of the network. That's not the image we now want to put out to our audience. End quote. So they fucking killed him.
That's great.
Yeah, teens love Michigan J. Frog. Do you want to keep talking about The Witcher?
Yeah, I do.
This has gotten so off the rails so early.
I want to tell you really quickly that you are right, that it is just a regular frog.
It's a
caveman who finds him.
Caveman?
Yeah. In the very first episode, it's a caveman who finds him.
Oh, that's fun.
But it is just a regular frog. And the reason that he's limp and lets the man dance him around, apparently, is just because he's just a regular old frog who, you know, frogs don't have muscles. Okay, so The Witcher... Yeah, you get basically the premise of it, and it's his job to go around. He's a hero for hire. Goes to different towns. They have a problem with a whatever their version of a Grendel is, and then he goes and destroys it. Now, if you've ever the game, which I'm somewhat familiar with, he's also like a really good detective. There's an element that they mentioned at the very beginning, which is that a Witcher can use the very most of their brawn, but they can also use the very most of their brain. And there's not a lot of that in the actual show. The show kind of meanders on like some other woman, Yennefer, and like her comeuppance and like who she becomes and how they kind of meet. And the story really requires you to watch every single episode to understand what's going on, as opposed to just like a Monster of the Week type of production. But one of the problems is that now there's no real time for Witcher to solve a lot of crimes because you do need him to be fighting something in every single episode. So there's a lot of just him just tearing shit up with his sword, but not a lot of him being a detective. I don't know if you used to watch also WB. Did you used to watch the Batman animated series?
Oh, of course.
There's a lot of good detective work in that. Batman's not just Batmaning guys the entire time. He's a really good detective, and the show works even for kids. You understand the logic and you follow it, and there's surprises and turns. And The Witcher does not try and do any of that. And it would be really cool to see that, I think, if it's not just him sticking his sword and stuff, if it's actually him being a detective too in this weird world. It's like you set up like an X-Files scenario where you've also got a Monster of the Week.
Do they rely upon you to utilize detective skills in the video game?
Yes.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're mad that they don't do any of that detective stuff because he's part Beowulf, part Batman, and they just stuck to the warrior aspects of him in the show.
Yeah, exactly. And there's nothing there. There's nothing more substantial there. And it's honestly, a lot of the overarching themes that they're trying to hit on and like the story that they're trying to create is not super compelling. It's much more fun to just watch him come up against something new he hasn't faced before, and now he's got to figure out what it is.
Do you remember that Batman animated series episode where Bruce Wayne gets amnesia and fucking forgets he's Batman? Like, he goes undercover and he's got white hair and like old man makeup, and then gets a concussion, and like the entire episode, he's just not Batman and he's stuck on some, like, I want to say prison plantation. Yeah, it's fucking great. I can't believe they made
the first season.
They made that for children. Just like, here's this Batman show where there are no jokes or laughs, and like, he doesn't be Batman for 30 minutes.
Yeah, he gets enslaved.
Yeah.
That's a weird episode. Yeah. That's right. The whole show is, I've been watching it with my son. He's a little young for it, but he gets excited about it because he knows he's young for it.
Yeah.
And we don't watch any Joker episodes because those really freak him out. But the rest of them we watch, and they're just so well made and good. And I would say, like, that intro sequence, you know what I'm talking about? It's all, it explains basically who Batman is without any words or anything.
Yeah.
You know exactly who he is. You know that he doesn't use guns, doesn't believe in them, that he can kick guys' asses without them. He's got this great tool belt. He's going to stop any bad guy there is and tie him up. Cops can come get him. That's Batman.
I also remember the title cards for every episode stand apart as like a piece of standalone art in a way that like I didn't appreciate when I was watching them, obviously, because it's like I don't care what the title of an episode is as a child. But now I think like, man, someone just fucking painted this beautiful like film noir piece to represent this episode. It's always very minimalist, and it's always got an intriguing title that's not like SpongeBob's Day at the Beach or like Batman goes hat shopping. It's always like a clever title in some way that just like exists as this beautiful splash that I bet I could probably buy them and like hang them in my apartment.
They are really cool. They really nail the gothic in every single one of those. But another show has started doing that. Mandalorian has started doing that in their credits at the end. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah. The illustrations. I hope they're hand-drawn illustrations.
It's gorgeous art, and it doesn't always match 100%. I think maybe they're building it off of just the script, but it's just, they're absolutely incredible. Sorry,
well,
you
TV
have one.
My TV show is going to be is much trashier than your thing. It's also a Netflix show. And before I dig into it, quick question. What do you know about the Netflix reality show Love is Blind?
Okay, I haven't watched it, but I know that it's similar to The Circle in that people aren't actually seeing one another until the very end.
So here's what I was also surprised by Love is Blind when I finally watched it, because it's billed as this show where men and women are separated and you go on dates in these pods where you can hear each other but not see each other, and you're just talking, and the stated experiment of the show is to find out if love actually is blind, if people can make a connection without seeing how attractive a person is, what anyone looks like, and then you I don't want to say win, but you pick someone and you get engaged to them before you see them. Like, that's what a successful couple is in this show. You don't like reach a point. It's not The Voice where you hit a button and now I want to see the person. You just have to decide, am I in love with this person that I'm talking to enough that I want to get engaged right now? So the first time you see the person that you've been talking to that you matched with, they are already your fiance. I thought the thrust of the show was going to be people in pods talking to each other without seeing each other, and then it ends with them getting engaged. But really, like, three episodes in, we're done with the pods, and then we just follow the couples. It's brilliant reality television. It's very fascinating, and some of the most compelling stuff that I've seen in years, because I didn't expect there to be like a narrative. I thought it was just going to be dating nonsense, and then like the trick would be the reveal at the end where it's like, oh, you look like that, oh no, credits. But you go with them to, like, now we're all going to stay at a resort together, all the couples who matched up are at a resort, now we're going to go back to our hometowns, now we're going to see what it's like when we meet like respective families and friends, and now we're going to like plan weddings for these couples. It's amazing. It's a real ride. But the thing I want to talk about is there's an interesting premise at the heart of Love is Blind that never really gets its day in court, I guess, because the point is starting from a place where you can't see the other person and you're just using your words and your experiences and your personality, your sense of humor, whatever, to win someone over and to see if, like, as corny as it sounds, to see if love really is blind or whatever. And one of the problems is the thing that everyone we focus on is what I would describe as normatively hot. Like, there are people who, after they get engaged, they go to a beautiful resort in Mexico and there's pools and beaches. So just at a base level, so you understand, you're dealing with people who are like, yes, I agree that it would make good television to see me shirtless or in a bathing suit making out on the beach. That's the kind of level of confidence that we're dealing with these contestants. That's how hot they are. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, it's in my head right now.
Yeah. But the really compelling thing is right in the beginning of the show, we meet a guy named Wesley, who is a guy who says, I should back up a little bit. There's like fucking 30 people total who are on this show, and we end up focusing on six couples, period. So there are a bunch of people that we don't follow up with because they don't match up or whatever, and we only follow the couples, and they're all iconic, and it's great. But right in the beginning of the show, you get this guy, Wesley, who says, I'm short, and women don't often date short guys, so I like this show, because we can make a connection before that comes up, as, in some cases, an immediate deal breaker. And I watched that, and I thought, yes, you are why this show exists. I understand that that is a deal breaker for a lot of women. This is going to be interesting. I can't wait for the moment that we see this seemingly nice, normatively attractive, shorter side guy meeting the love of his life three episodes from now. We also meet another man, Taylor, who all the men hang out and all the women hang out and they never see each other, etc. But the men are like drinking and having a good time, and Taylor reveals to the other men that he is a virgin, and he's like not scared or shy about it. He was like, this is a choice that I've made. I want to be respectful. Like, there's a chance he's an insane person. Because he's like, women grow up, they're looking for a Prince Charming, so I just want to be a Prince Charming to the princess, and I want to, like, do the right thing. And there's a chance that he's, like, genuine and sweet and amazing, and also a chance that he's, like, some kind of sociopath. I don't know. But it's a 30-something-year-old guy who's like, I'm a virgin, and I'm doing this show, and I want to see if that's going to matter in the context of this show. And so right off the bat, this is within 10 minutes of the pilot of this show that we meet our fucking short king Wesley and adult virgin Taylor. And I was like, this is going to be so cool to see what happens with these people. And Soren, we never see either of them again.
No. Oh. What happened? They get kicked off or what?
No, no one gets kicked off of the show. The show just decides to focus on who they want to focus on. And it's all of like the tall, hot people who end up being couples. And like, you start off with a premise where it is a show that is exactly made for someone like Wesley, where he's got like a documented history where physical appearance has been a deal breaker in past relationships. And he's never gotten to a certain point because it was a deal breaker, and this would be his chance to do that. And like, yeah, that's the promise of this show. That's the only reason right. to do this show is for people like Wesley and Taylor. And then we don't follow them. We just follow fucking hot people, just like these tall guys named Barnett and Damien and some other nonsense I can't remember. And we just follow these couples as they go to resorts and we find out if they're going to get married or not. And the weird thing is, like, it's not so surprising that they didn't follow every single person on the show, because some of them never coupled up. But Wesley, our short king, did get engaged. He didn't end up getting married to this person, but that doesn't matter. He did get engaged and, like, went through all the same steps that everyone else on the show that we did follow go through. And I only know that he got engaged because I immediately after 4 episodes of the show, I was like, where the fuck is Wesley? Where's my guy? Why did we lose the only person who had like a compelling reason to be on this show? And the producer was just like, yeah, we just decided not to follow him.
So they didn't follow her either.
No.
That's wild. Why would they do that though?
I don't know.
Is the rest of the show good?
It's, I mean, good is difficult. It's compelling. There's it's one of the things that simultaneously spoiled the show for me and also made it make a lot of sense for me is that the way they casted it was they went out, they reached out to the people who were on the show in the first season. They reached out through Instagram. They just like saw people who had large Instagram followings and were like posting a lot of pictures of themselves on Instagram. So like already you've got like, there are people who want to be on a reality show essentially. Yeah. Like they're influencer type people, even though they have other jobs. Most of them, they're like, definitely I'm an influencer type person. I want attention. I want to like, I'm building up my brand as a person. I would like to make a career out of being me, out of being Barnett or whatever. So that's how the producers found them. They went out to people's different Instagram feeds and private messaged them and were like, would you like to be on a dating show? And do you want to get married soon? And people were just like, yes, I want to do that.
Oh, okay.
And so you've got, by design, you've got a bunch of people who have the benefit of having watched decades of reality television and knowing how to be a compelling reality television character. So I'm never really bored during the show because even if it's just people meeting each other's parents, I'm following a woman named Giannina Milady Jabelli. Her middle name is Milady Soren. Of course, of course I want to see her get married.
Maybe what's happening here is, so I did watch The Circle and I really, know. Okay. So it's when you first tune into it, the first episode is nearly impossible to get through. It's so bad. And so such a clear aping of reality television that's already figured itself out. Like Netflix is just trying to establish its foothold in reality television with this show. And they're just trying to play on every single element you'd be familiar with, but it all feels very synthetic in this way. Then it gets much better because the people who are in the show kind of take over telling the story of what's going on. And they are very interesting. Each one of them is a really unique, strange person. And they keep opening these doors on their lives just to crack and then shutting that door again. And so you're finding out strange things about these people the entire time. I wouldn't say strange. I should say heartening. Like you're finding out really nice things about these people that makes them very human to you. And maybe that's what they're also doing here is that they know what a reality show should look like. And they're like, we need to do that first. We need to prove that we can make just a normal reality show before we start making a unique one.
Yeah. They certainly did that. It certainly has all the ingredients of like, let's get hot people together and cut them off from the rest of the world and then give them unlimited alcohol and see what happens. And like,
it's,
you know,
great.
That's worked for Real World and Jersey Shore for decades. So it's fine. But I want to see the version of Love is Blind that is like more true to the experiment, I guess, even though that might make for less compelling television. I'm just like very, like just at least give us one couple that tries to live up to the promise of this premise. Instead of just like anytime the couples met each other for the first time, they're like, oh, good, you're hot. Yeah, me too. And all my friends are hot. This will be great. I don't know why I was worried.
I'll tell you, without ruining too much about The Circle, there's the premise of it is that you can come in being whoever you want. The only way you're talking to people is through text messaging. So you don't actually ever see anybody else. You can see their profile pictures.
Like that. I would be so good at that.
Of course you would, Dan. Like, you built your whole life being great at that. So they have profile pictures, so they can put up pictures of whoever they want. And so a lot of them do catfish throughout it. And there's one woman who comes clean in the middle of an episode she's pretending to be somebody else. Who's this like insanely hot woman. And she comes clean. She's to a group of girls and she pulls them aside in a chat and she's like, I want to be honest with you. I want to tell you who I really am. This is who I am. And she puts up an actual picture of herself. And they're all like, so brave. You look beautiful. You didn't need to do this. And then it gets revealed to everybody else. And they're all, because all of a sudden that's her profile picture now. And they're all very, very supportive. They kick her out at the end of the episode.
Why?
It has to do a lot with politics, but I mean, my heart also tells me that it was that they were just like,
oh, I don't like her.
I think one other reason for you to watch Love is Blind is the jobs that people have.
Just a second. It may be the next episode that she gets kicked off, but it's like within like a day or two.
Go on.
The jobs people have, I don't know if these are the jobs that they put forward, or if the producers just like did enough fishing to find out what could I defensively put in the Chyron as their job, because all of the jobs are bonkers. There's like, you meet a woman whose song is like, yeah, I'm just trying to find love, I want to get married. And you see on the bottom of the screen, it's like, Amber, 27 years old, parentheses, ex-tank mechanic. And then it cuts to someone else who's like, yeah, you know, I tried the apps and it's not working. And then it's like, Diamond, parentheses, professional basketball dancer. I'm like, what's happening here?
Yeah, that's so. When I said that you learn more about the characters in the circle, they do. You don't get their jobs at the beginning. All you get is like this archetype. It's like this guy fills the role of basically a Jersey Shore boy. This woman fills the role of like the I'm not here to make friends type of person. And as then you like these people who you're just geared up to hate from the beginning, suddenly you'll find out that one of them works exclusively with autistic children. That's like her job, and teaching them and getting them to come out of their shell. And you're just like, oh shit, you're a real person. Yeah. All right. And then you start to sort of feel for them a little bit more. But I'm always baffled by the ways that shows, like what shows think is important information for you to get up front and for you to consistently be bombarded with throughout the episode. When I watch the show Alone, which I've recently been talking about, in Alone, it's super important for me to know how old everybody is every 30 seconds. Yeah. There's a little Chyron that appears and it's like, Davis, 32. It's like, I mean, who cares? That gives me no more information.
Yeah. Love is Blind spends an inordinate amount of time in the pilot explaining the premise of the show to you, which is a very simple premise. It has like Nick Lachey and his wife. I hate to identify her as that, but I don't know her name off the top of my head. They are ostensibly the hosts of the show, and they come out and they tell the contestants very simply, like, so you're going to be separated and you're going to take turns. It's going to be like speed dating. You go from pod to pod to meet people that you can't see, try to form a connection with, and then hopefully you get engaged and then you get married and you make that commitment that you will get married to a person, or you will get engaged to a person by the end of the show. And I was like, got it. That was an informative 15 seconds. And then they do it like three or four more times. Like because I had friends who watched the show. So I made a note to pause at like the 6 minute and 45 second mark. They were still explaining the premise of this very easy to grasp show. And then you don't even see Nick Lachey and, forgive me, his wife again until the final episode, where they're just like, hey, remember us? We're technically hosting this. it's time for the weddings.
I think I have to watch this.
I think you should.
You've swayed me.
There's also, I think, another missed opportunity with this show, and I won't spoil this part for you, is the character or person, I guess, of Carlton is very interesting, and it's another storyline that gets dropped, even though it has like one of the most naturally compelling and dramatic arcs. We end up ignoring it and instead focusing on, all the weird hot couples.
Yeah.
It's tough. I don't want to spoil anything, but I also want to make this a good podcast. It's just very interesting.
I think you could just say it. I think it's fine. People can turn it off if they want to.
Yeah. He's like, there's some like very toxic elements to his behavior that are very troubling. But also we learn in the course of a few episodes that he is very likely bisexual and struggling with that, and kept that from his partner until after they'd already got engaged. Oh. And you watch that unfold, and his handling of it is not great. Her handling of it is better, but also not perfect. And it's just like, this is an incredibly compelling subject that you don't really see handled on certainly on television almost anywhere. This like this strange struggle and what it means for this couple. And then we just sort of forget about them and move on.
Have you read up on if anybody else has the same complaint as you?
The Ringer did a great piece about Wesley and Taylor, the short guy and the virgin guy.
Okay.
But
it's, I'm trying to think of like where this started. Cause usually when they, it was a dead giveaway in early reality television, when they really started going into somebody's backstory, that person was going to be on the show for a while. Like we're learning more about them. This is important. And then the people who are going to be off early or that we're not going to follow, like they just don't bother. And then it started to maybe change. I don't know. I don't know if this is true. Off the top of my mind, I'd say that it started to change around the Olympics when like those stories from reality television started to bleed into sports where you wanted to know why you should give a shit about this woman skiing moguls. And so we're like, all right, well, let's find out about her whole backstory. Let's find out who she is. Yes, now I can root for her. And then the minute she's out, we don't think about her ever again. And we're all kind of fine with that. And I think reality television just realized, oh, you're allowed to do that. You can give all this information about somebody and then never talk about them again. And nobody cares.
Yeah.
I don't know. That might be wrong, but it feels right in my heart.
Yeah. Do you have any questions for me?
I do. Yeah. You think we have time for it?
Yeah. I don't know.
It's a short one.
Yeah.
Dan, what's some music or an artist that you respect, you accept that they're probably objectively all right, but that you can't possibly listen to because your parents played them into the ground when you were a kid?
Oh.
I can go first here.
Yeah, please do.
So James Taylor, somebody who I know is inarguably a good musician. People love him. Even if you're not into folk music or whatever, trop rock, I don't know what he does. Whatever you're interested in, he still can cross those lines. He's a very good musician. His songs are objectively great, I think, I assume, given his success. And yet I can't even listen to like a single verse of one of his songs. If it's on at the grocery store, I will leave the grocery store because it's so much of my childhood was spent listening to that. And then also, well, this is revealing a lot, but I grew up in a cabin in the woods growing up. And when you go to sleep at night, it's like the whole world disappeared. The whole world shut off because it's completely dark up there. There's no light or anything. There's no sounds. And so when I would see my parents' light go out, it really meant I was alone in the world. And that was really scary when I was a kid, when I was like 9 or 10. And so sometimes I would cry and so I'd be crying in my bed, but my brother lived in the room below me and he could hear that I was crying. And instead of, you know, coming to see if I was okay or anything, he would just turn on James Taylor and turn it up because that happened to be what was in his CD player forever. And this is a time, you know, when we're still kids, you were young enough that we're listening to whatever our parents listened to and he had that CD. And so that's James Taylor has these very awful connotations of loneliness in my mind. And also when we go up to on hut trips, huts are there. This is also going to be hard tough to explain. There are huts all over Colorado that are, anyone can go use. You can go out to a hut as long as you tell the Forest Service, like, I want to go out to the Margie hut. You, in the winter, you might snowshoe up there, cross country ski up there. And then it's fresh tracks all over. You can just ski wherever you want. You stay in the hut at night. Okay. Like an A-frame, maybe the size of a garage, a two-car garage. Some of them are much bigger than that, but most of them are pretty small. And they were created by, I want to say this might be wrong, the 10th Mountain Division when they came back might have started the hut system in Colorado. But there are huts all over, up in the mountains. They're very difficult to get to. Usually there's no roads. So you either, in the winter, you skin up, which means that you put skins on the bottoms of your skis, or in the summer, you hike to them. And then in the summer, you do a lot of work at them. You stain the outside, you chop wood, and you get it ready for the winter. And that's part of the allowing you to stay in this hut. Something we used to do a lot as a kid, when I was a kid, and I loved doing it. But on the way up, we'd listen to James Taylor too. So on the way back down, I would have these sort of sad memories of like, well, that's over. Like we're not, you know, that letdown at the end of a trip that you like. And so because it was so much a part of my childhood, I can't listen to it anymore. It's
there's just too much in it, and it's over for me.
Yeah. I mean, here's just one small thing about that. Imagine you, Soren, were being told a story right now by someone who was very casually just like, yeah, and then when I was in my early 20s, I invented chipmunks. I just thought of a way that you could like take squirrels and make them smaller because they didn't have them before. And I was like, maybe make a completely new animal, which I did using my third hand. By the way, I was listening to a lot of Natalie Imbruglia at the time when I was inventing chipmunks before anyone had ever invented them. And that's why I want to talk about Natalie Imbruglia right now. That's what you just did. You told an insane story about covering your skis with skins, which my mind ran with, and then going to a hut and staining it for other people for the winter.
I'll tell you.
And then you're like, and that's why I can't listen to James Taylor. You fucking lunatic.
As I started to
You buried the lead under miles of snow.
As I started to talk about James Taylor and realizing in my mind why it's so, I can't listen to it. I was like, there's no good way to get through these stories. So I'm just going to fly.
And I was like, crying alone in my room while my brother blasted James Taylor.
It's really, really tough to tell that story without any backstory. Oh man, I don't know how to, I didn't know any other way to get through it. Like I don't. As soon as I realized, I was like, oh, I have these such fond memories of going up to the getting sandwiches from Pepino's and then going up to the huts with my dad. And I was like, oh fuck, he didn't know what any of that shit is.
So you stayed in a hut.
Yeah, you stay in them.
Are there beds in the hut, or is it you bring your own sleeping bag and you sleep on the floor in the hut?
You could sleep just on it, on the beds, but here it's basically set up like it's a long, long bench in most of them, and then there are some pads on the bench. It's like hostel circumstances, okay. Right?
Like a lean-to? So,
no, it's not a lean-to. I mean, it's an actual it's a real structure. Okay. So when I say A-frame, it just means like one of those houses that's just completely, it looks like it's only roof.
Okay.
It makes an upside down V and it comes all the way down on both sides. And it's about the size of a two car garage,
you
but it's like,
to
it's structurally
what
sound.
An A-frame is by saying it's an upside down V.
Well, you said a lean to, and I thought maybe I wasn't being specific enough. A lean to is very savage. Very primitive. It has a stove in it, and it's got
got a toilet.
No, that's an outhouse. Got to go outside.
I know what outhouse means. God damn it.
Wow. Don't look. You understand that, like, I'm in the weeds as far as what you actually understand. I had to go through the whole huts, and I didn't, it just felt so a priori to me growing up. I don't know what people know.
And you stain them just sort of as like a, like community service. Like it's like an understood social contract that the whole community works to preserve the huts for future use.
Yes, exactly. You go up there and you take care of it. You're also going to maybe be cutting down some trees that are around it. There's just like, I don't know if they actually give you, they must give you jobs. I was a kid, so this portion of it I was never involved in, but they must tell you, this is what we need done up there. And then you go up and you do that.
Fascinating. My answer is not like that, Soren.
Okay. You're going to tell me the Beatles?
Yeah.
Are you?
And specifically Hard Day's Night. And it's not even like my parents drove anything into the ground. Like I really love the musical taste that I inherited from my parents. Like they, like very early on, we listened to a lot of James Taylor, Simon Garfunkel, Joni Mitchell, Carly Simon, Beatles. That's Elton John. That's all my mom's side of things. My dad's side of things was Yes and Moody Blues and REO Speedwagon. And these are all bands that I still like today. And they weren't like forcing a lot of it on us or anything like that. And they weren't replaying albums into the ground or anything, but we got we already liked the Beatles as kids because of our parents. And then we got a copy of the Hard Day's Night Beatles movie on VHS. And I watched that into the ground. I watched that over and over again. I loved it so much, like, because I already liked the music. And it seemed really cool to me that, like, they made a movie around an album, which felt like a very new concept to me at the time because I was a child. And just seeing musicians as characters was very fascinating to me. And so I would just sit and watch it over and over again. My brothers would too. And now that's just an album that I don't listen to at all. I still listen to a lot of Beatles, but I can't remember the last time I listened to a single song from that album, just because as soon as it comes up randomly on iTunes or Spotify, I'm just like, oh no, yeah, I get it. I've heard it enough times that, like, I'm not going to find anything new in this anymore.
Right. You've exhausted it completely.
Yeah.
I have a few of those too. You were saying, like, bands that you still like today that your parents listen to. And a lot of those, there's some overlap with my parents, like Joni Mitchell.
Yeah.
Like, my parents were into, like, Gordon Lightfoot and Leo Kottke and bands, mm-hmm. like, and now I don't know if it was at some point where I just felt like I needed to distance myself from that. I can't listen to any of those anymore. I can't listen to Joan Baez, certainly.
Oh.
Or, like, Bonnie Raitt. Like, that's all, I'm sure it was good music at the time. It's really, it feels so part of my parents' identity that I'm like, no, it's not for me.
Oh, so sometimes I'll put on Simon and Garfunkel now, and cause, like, I they're not in, like, a regular, they're not on any of my playlists that are my go-to listening playlists, but mm-hmm. I'll just decide, like, I want to listen to their Live at Central Park concert or, you know, whatever, older stuff than that, and immediately I'll think, why do I listen to anything else? They did the best music. This is perfect. And last time I was in North Carolina visiting my parents, Slip Sliding Away came on the radio.
Great song.
Yeah. And I talked to my mom about that. I was like, this was on, like, every mix CD I made for myself in college. And she didn't have mix CDs, obviously, but she was like, yeah, me too. This is also an important song in my college life. And it was just, like, a nice bonding thing.
Oh, interesting.
With my mom and I. Yeah.
You have the same seminal song. That's so cool.
I do. Yeah. We also had, somewhat related, we went in anticipation of my brother's marriage, we went not for, like, a bachelor party, but, like, all my brothers and my dad and I went out to just have a few beers, and we were listening to Dream Theater, which is a modern band. It's a progressive rock prog metal band that we were listening to, and my brothers and I all like it. Like, we've seen them in concert a bunch of times. They're a great band. You should check them out. My dad was into it too for the first time. And he was like, what is this? We're like, it's Dream Theater. We used to go to their concerts. He was like, this sounds like the music that happened when I was a kid. Cause I, like, they were heavily influenced by all the prog rock bands that my dad liked growing up. So that was another nice bonding experience, because he's at a point, I think, where he doesn't expect anything new to resonate with him in the same way that he did when he was younger. So the fact that he's now come across this music that, like, means a whole lot to my brothers and I, and also reminds him of his favorite bands, is a cool little thing for him.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I'm curious what my son will think about the stuff that I listen to now, because I play a lot of music in the house. He dances to a lot of it, so I know he knows certain songs. That as he gets older, I wonder if he'll also embrace that type of music and be like, oh, my dad listens to good music, or if he'll just be like, fuck this.
Yeah.
I need my own thing. Where's Columbia House? Send me 14 new sure CDs.
I'm sure your son will be asking, where's Columbia House?
Yeah, they'll have the same experience that I did when I was 11 years old.
It's very funny to watch. Whenever I'm around my three-year-old nephew, and there's Alexa in their house, so he can just say, Alexa, play this song that I like. And sometimes it's just, God damn it. And sometimes it's just a, like, definitely a song for children about garbage trucks or police cars.
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna pause because Alexa is screaming in the background. Alexa, stop.
Gabe, please leave this in.
So sometimes it's garbage trucks or police cars. And sometimes you just say, he'll say, hey, Alexa, can you play Light 'Em Up? And then she knows that that means the Fall Out Boy song.
Yeah.
Light 'Em Up, I'm on Fire song. And then he just dances to that.
That's great. It's so fun when you finally get their proclivities, like the things that they're really interested in. My son also likes a song from them called Young Volcanoes. It's like one of his favorite songs.
Well, I'll see if Murphy likes it.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else while we wrap this up?
Sorry. It's not Panic at the Disco. Fall Out Boy. I'm so sorry.
Wait, did I say Fall Out Boy or did I say Panic?
I can't remember. I barely listen to you most of the time.
That's smart.
I Light 'Em up. Oh, that is Fall Out Boy, right?
That's Fall Out Boy, yeah.
Okay, good.
And I think I said Fall Out Boy.
You did.
Okay. Well, we're clearly out of steam. I need to track down all the social accounts to close this out, but
okay, go ahead.
And that takes me a minute. So while I'm
it's fine.
That,
silence is fine. We can cut it out later. It's really easy.
Because I did have something to say, and I know you did too. The coronavirus continues to make a tremendous impact on the world, not just in terms of health, but also socially, economically, and culturally. A less pressing but still impactful side effect has been the suspension of various movie and television shoots, with some shows being delayed or outright canceled, and some movies like the latest James Bond being pushed indefinitely. My question for Soren is, what was it like losing your virginity?
Well, I was very in my head the whole time, so I wasn't totally present, I would say. So when people talk about how you should wait until you're in love with somebody and make sure that you're emotionally ready, I would say to that, why bother, you know, because it's all about you the first time anyway. You're not really focused on the other person. It's all up in your noggin. It's you watching the story of your own life, because that's what everybody does. That's not selfish. That's you experiencing a new experience, but you've only been taught to experience experiences through television. And so everything is through the lens of somebody actually watching it and not actually you experiencing it. And your reactions to it better not be well-trod territory. Like, you better not have some sort of emotional reaction that you would see on television, because you've seen that 100 times. So you have to do something brand new. That's why I cried. And then
I found the accounts.
Okay.
You can ask Soren follow-up questions at Soren_LTD, or you can talk to me at DLB_INC, or Bacon once more at Make Me Bacon Please PLS. Those are all on Twitter. You can email the show at qqwithsorenanddaniel@gmail.com. Tell us what you'd like to hear more about in that email, I guess. The show is on Twitter at twitter.com/qq_sorenanddan. We're also on Instagram. You can find and hire our amazing engineer, producer, editor, Gabe, at gabeharder.com. We also have Patreon, but honestly, if you have some money, there's probably like a food bank or a neighbor that you can give it to. So, like, ignore us for a little while. And I believe that's it. Those are all the plugs.
On the next episode, we should really come up with the best places to put your money or to give money right now.
Yeah.
Feels like a good idea. And then, because we're somebody you can trust, you see.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You have anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
Bye.